Welcome to Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Gregor Baylor to the broadcast. Gregor is an independent investor, executive advisor, industry speaker, and international philanthropist. Gregor retired from Capital One in late 2007, where he was CIO and where he led an industry-recognized technology team that was pivotal to Capital One's diversification and innovation strategies. The company transformed itself from a monoline credit card supplier to one of the top 10 diversified banks in the United States, reinventing nearly all of its processes along the way. Together with his teams, Gregor has been recognized through dozens of awards, including multiple CIO 100 awards, several years as Computer World's Best Places to Work in IT, and the top ranking in the Information Week 500. Gregor himself is named one of the most influential persons in information technology by eWeek, one of the hottest CIOs in financial services by Future Banker, and one of the top 20 most influential financial IT executives by the CIO Forum. In 2007, Gregor was inducted into the CIO Hall of Fame by CIO Magazine. Prior to his time at Capital One, Gregor headed up operations and technology at the NASDAQ stock market during both the dot-com boom and 9/11. He worked at Citibank before that as a chief technology architect for the corporate banking division and managing director in the advanced development division. He also served in key strategic and management positions at Perot Systems, Next Computer, and Hewlett-Packard. Gregor is an active environmentalist and was the founding executive sponsor of Capital One's Environmental Council. He's a director at the Corporate Executive Board and for the National Wildlife Federation. He's currently working on several projects to create more sustainable solutions combating global warming and poverty. I recently spoke with Gregor in Northern Virginia, where our conversation touched on World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed Capital One's Future of Work initiative, Principle 2, Infrastructure, as we discussed the many disasters that he has seen his companies through and the lessons he has learned from them, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discuss Gregor's thoughts on business alignment, as well as a variety of other topics. Well, Gregor Baylor, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Great. Well, Gregor, in light of all that's happening in the economy now, all the vicissitudes of American and global business, I wonder if you can share a perspective on where we stand now and your own perspectives. I know you've been traveling a lot internationally. You still sit on boards of many companies here in the United States. What do you see as technology and the tech executives' role in assisting businesses in navigating the waters currently and getting towards recovery?
Well, it's a great question. It is an incredible time to be a technologist right now, because it is a time where, if you look at the history of recoveries, every recovery in the history of the stock market certainly has followed by an infrastructure build-out, an investment time. Mm-hmm. And through that, an innovation time. And so, like those, one would expect that the investments we're making now are going to create needs for technologists to be the chaperones, I'll call it, of the recovery. Mm-hmm. So it is an incredibly important time for a CIO to really think through what are the priorities and how do I make sure that I've got the right priorities with my business. And I think that would be the place I would focus first. Mm-hmm. It's a time where businesses are perhaps thrashing, looking for the solution, looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, looking for a way to make themselves stay above water, and in fact perhaps be prepared for that recovery. And because of that, they may be wandering a bit, and that what was a high priority last month might not be a high priority this month. And so the alignment with the subject matter of priority with your businesses is probably more critical than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. At the same time, staff is a bit nervous. These are times when efficiency and costs and restructuring is going on rampantly. Mm-hmm. And so as a staff member in an IT organization or in a company, you're bound to be wondering, am I right for this? Am I a right fit for the next job?
Right.
Do I have the right career skills? Is this company going to be here? Is my skill set going to be changed or going to need to change to react to that? And so I would say the second place is to be focused on your people and understanding, you know, empathetically to some degree, but also just humanly what they're going through and understanding how to be clear, how to create compelling stories about where you need to go and why you need to go there, how to be honest. You know, these are times when people will be looking for the story or what's behind the notions of the actions or what are the things that we should be intuiting between the lines.
Yes.
And so it's a very important time for the CIO, particularly, or any executive, to be able to be grounded and authentic with the conversations they're making with their people and be valuing the people that they really need in a way that the person can understand that. It's also a time to be planning for what is that next thing. And when you think through those priorities or when you think through the skill sets and the people that you have, combinations or disaggregations that are going on in the company or in the industry, how do you navigate that strategy? And how do you create steps that will lead the company and perhaps allow your company to be competitive in the industry?
Yes.
So, you know, that notion about people is always a top of mind list item for me. But I think it needs to be focused on in a very different way because you're almost in a crisis mode. You know, it's I don't think people want to see this as an everyday crisis mode like a disaster, but it has a lot of the attributes where people are nervous, people don't necessarily have a plan, and they're looking for great leadership to lead them out of that. I would say the next one, of course, is keeping the infrastructure working. It sounds silly. But there's so much change going on, and in fact, the ability for you to derail things that maybe still need to happen because a high priority item that appears to be you know, a business innovation or a change in the atmosphere, a control issue, could take you off plan. And so, again, back to the alignment with the business, being very clear about how those things align, but knowing that you've got to keep the infrastructure running and you've got to keep it up to date, you've got to keep things that are important and urgent working, I think has to remain a focus.
That's a great point. And I'd like to linger on the point about people for a second. You make very good points about how this is a time to value people, to make sure that those, and especially for those organizations who naturally through the course of a downturn may have had to let go of some folks. And so therefore, friends and colleagues of perhaps of a long tenure might no longer be there. I wonder what sort of role you see in the evaluation or the development of cultural type analysis or a reconfirmation as to what the direction of the organization is for those who remain, likely those people that are still with you, if you've had to go through the painful process of letting some folks go, are your best people, the ones you do want to have with you when the recovery happens. How do you, are there different ways of developing those plans, of communicating the vision, of communicating the culture from there, that point forward and so forth?
Crises challenge your culture the most. They accentuate the things that are most valued in the organization and expose in its rawest form, for the good and the bad, your culture. So that's a great point. In the time of crisis and in a time of need like this, you're going to have decisions that are made that are blunt instruments to expose your culture. Whether you acknowledge it or not, those actions are embodiments for your people of what the culture really is.
Yeah, good point.
So it is a time to, I'll call, re-recruit your best people. And it can be done by making sure that the actions that are being taken are being done in a way that is consistent with the culture. And to the degree it's not, that you explain that maybe there's a change. Maybe that is a change in a cultural value that says, you know, we can't provide employment forever, per se, in every role. We have to provide skill management for you, for instance. Or retraining, or, you know, whatever it may be that is this specific situation. But the reality is you're absolutely going to be exposing the good and bad of the culture more so now than ever before. And it is a time to actually stand and look at that and expose that and talk about it with your people. Make sure that you can explain actions within the context that you want them to be understood in the culture. And I think the notion of re-recruiting your best and your brightest and the folks that you need. And I would say that that's not always just the top management, by the way. You know, when I talked about running the infrastructure in a situation like this and the need to have really good operations, you know, those are folks that aren't necessarily at the top.
They're
maybe many layers below the top, but they're just as important to go after and say, here's what these actions mean, here's why we're doing them, and here's why it's the right thing for the company to do, and we're doing it in a way that is respectful and consistent with our culture.
Yeah, great points. Staying on the topic of people, but in a different direction, while you were at Capital One, you championed a program that you refer to as the Future of Work, in which you personally gave up your own office and encouraged a lot of other people to do the same thing. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, the genesis of the idea, the reason for doing it, as well as the value that you got out of doing that.
Well, it's a great initiative from a Capital One perspective, because it really was a partnership between the folks in the facilities organization, the HR organization, and the technology organization, in response to and in direct collaboration with the businesses. So it was an all-encompassing effort, so to speak.
Yes.
And it comes out of a few notions. One of them is the facilities folks and the HR folks were seeing that buildings weren't being used the same way they had been being used.
Yes.
Offices, for instance, and cubicles were remaining empty while people crowded into the few conference rooms that were available. Managers and employees were having a different relationship because employees were going from one project to the next, maybe many projects within a year. And the notion of who was appraising you at the end of the year was kind of a bit fluid. So there's a change in the relationship because of the notion of how people were actually working on projects. And what we found was that efficiency and innovation itself are accelerated by small teams. The notion that you have too big a team is not good, because you end up with kind of a dissolution or a watering down of the vision and an inability for people to see their direct responsibility. And too small bifurcation of things, when people are all in their little cubicles, you tend to not have the vibrance that you need for innovation. So we found that we needed to move to a team orientation, and we needed to provide that both in the building structures, in the ways that your kind of flow of administrative tasks happened, such as appraisal and filing your expenses. And we needed to have the technology there to make all that fluid. So the genesis came out of, you know, five or six different points of light that pointed towards this, I'll call it Starbucks-esque environment that emerged. But we had a lot of things we had to work on. We had to work on how do you do appraisals when you're mostly going to be involved with groups and teams as opposed to a single manager for a reasonable amount of time. We had to figure out how to make it possible for you to not be in your office and still do all your quote-unquote paperwork.
Yeah.
Basically make it all electronic. We needed to think about what tools you needed when you were working in a team. What was the innovation platform for work in a team? And so it was interesting because it really required us to think in lots of different ways. And Capital One is great for testing things and modeling things. So we have many different building cubicle organizational kind of models. We had several different methodologies we looked at for how teams work well. And we got busy on the technology side of automating and making everything electronic along the way. And what we found is that people really did want to work that way. They wanted to work in their teams. They spent more of their time in their teams. They wanted to be able to not have to be in the office to do their expense reports and file other administrative task work. They needed to have access to the team's mind. What were the concepts that were being developed in this team orientation, and how could they continue to work collaboratively without having to be in the conference room, without having to be on the phone the entire time?
Yes.
And so the tools that emerged were simple and yet focused a lot on collaboration and on processes that would allow us to make that innovation and, in the end, create efficiencies, quite frankly. I mean, we were able to reduce the need for buildings by quite a bit because you could put a lot more people into a space that was not dividing it up into 10 by 10 cubicles. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you could raise employee satisfaction when you did that, mm-hmm. which was phenomenal because, you know, a lot of people were at first, oh, I like my office or I like my private space.
Right.
But when they actually went about doing the work in the new way, it was more conducive. It was modeled to be more conducive to what they were really doing. Mm-hmm. And so people really came on board. And they pushed things, you know, that they needed. I need a private space for consultation, so let's have some private space carols or offices. Mm-hmm. We need more conference rooms.
Yes.
we used a methodology for product development called Agile, mm-hmm. and that one really became kind of a point of innovation around process and around how do you think about teams. And because of the way that worked and it ran like wildfire through all of the project teams, it also gave us feedback. Mm-hmm. What things should we do more of? What things should we do less of in these team rooms, these project rooms? So it really came out of the grassroots, in a sense. It wasn't something we said, gosh, we need to, you know, reduce the building's utilization, so let's figure out how to not have offices. Mm-hmm. It really came out of people saying, this is the way we're doing work, and this is a better way to serve the employee and give them better tools. And because of that, and because it was organic in nature, it really became very effective.
That's great. I think I'm hearing several layers of value that were achieved in terms of efficiency of the people, the collaboration. I imagine a lot less walking great distances to carry out meetings with people that you need to see on a regular basis since they're in the same space as you, if that's in fact the case, in addition to the documentation, the facilities, and so forth.
And it was timely because it was also kind of the heyday of the introduction of Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. and other tools in the social networking space,
yes.
and blogging and all. So the reality was we were kind of reacting to the consumer technologies also.
I see.
And bringing them into the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a little bit of a funny story around a workspace that was created in the overlap of Wi-Fi between multiple buildings, which is outside. And in fact, what was created was a treehouse in the middle of the campus in our Richmond facility. When I was there, there happened to be good space, and eventually we put a Wi-Fi access point right there. But there's actually a treehouse that's built up on a platform, nestled into a tree, and that's probably the number one conference room space, in good weather,
right?
That people argued for, and so you would actually see people wandering about waiting for the treehouse.
That's fantastic.
With their Wi-Fi enabled.
That's really great. Well, Gregor, when you were inducted in the CIO Magazine Hall of Fame, you indicated that, and I'm quoting you, what's most important about being a CIO isn't technical prowess, it's the ability to engage with the right people who will rally around the right ideas and help make them possible. And I wonder if you can, I think it's a compelling notion, I wonder if you can explain that a little bit more.
Well, I think that having been a lifelong geek, and I will admit to that myself. I'm deeply involved in technologies and love the next generation of whatever. Mm-hmm. I learned, though, early on that leadership is all about inspiration, mm-hmm. Engagement, mm-hmm. and trust. And that's true in the technology roles as well as in other leadership roles.
Yes.
And so while it's important for a CIO to be technically savvy and intelligent and able to kind of ferret through complex problems, mm-hmm. it is obligatory for them to be able to have the attributes of inspiration, engagement, and trust. Mm-hmm. And that's centered in people. Mm-hmm. And that's centered in emotion. It's centered in passion. Ever more so than in the past, but I think it was always true, CIOs are being asked to kind of be more robust in their capabilities and more of a strategy player, more of a business leader. And so the notion that your leadership qualities as a CIO are more related to people, strategy, and being able to send the right message, get people engaged, get them rallied around the right plan, you know, I think that that really is what makes it a world-class CIO.
That makes a lot of sense. I wonder if, do you see a shift in the balance? Obviously, people need to be tech savvy in order to be the IT executive, to be a CIO. Do you see a point in time coming when people may not need to have or the reliance upon a technical background that is growing up in the IT department, an engineering degree, these sorts of badges that were required in the past, where that's going to become lessened because of some of what you're discussing? Can it be learned on the job, do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of aspects of the job that can be learned.
Yeah.
But I think there's a couple of things that complicate it. Mm-hmm. If your seat as a CIO is absolutely needed in the company, the reason it's needed is because there's a translation role between the business objectives of the company and the management of the technology to service that business objective.
Yes.
If that isn't needed, then maybe it's called something other than a CIO. So my point is that I think that the CIO role isn't going away. Mm-hmm. I think there are ever more complicated business models. There's ever more complicated technology, privacy issues, technology security issues, et cetera, that are emerging and continue to emerge. And so the notion that you've got some sort of a chaperone around those issues, mm-hmm. who can also speak business strategy,
yes.
and people strategy, and understand, you know, what a board is thinking and what a shareholder is thinking, I don't think that's going away.
Right, right.
I think it's critical for a CIO to remember that one of the most important aspects of their job is to educate and continue to challenge the business player on the technology space. Because those companies that are most effective, where technology is an important piece of their business, have business leaders who are, I'll call them, dangerous with technology. They know enough to be dangerous. And that makes them push things. That makes them innovate in different ways than they would otherwise. And I use the example of, you know, Frank Gehry or Frank Lloyd Wright in the kind of more classical architecture space. I mean, these guys were innovators because, and are still, because, in the case of Gehry,
yes.
because they know the building materials of their trade, and they push the building materials of their trade. They push it beyond the level of anybody else in their trade. And they get in and understand, how does steel manufacturing work? What can I do differently? How can I make forms that are, you know, much different than anyone has ever done before? How do I use the physical environment in a way that is different again and more effective?
Yes.
And that whole stream of being really savvy about the building materials of your trade translates directly into business and the use of technology. And I think in a lot of companies, actually, the CIO hasn't got the voice or hasn't got the interaction or personal relationships enough with some of the business players to make sure that they're actually continuing to educate themselves and stay on top of what could be some new innovation or new way of thinking about their business. And, you know, they get trumped by someone else who does.
Yes.
There's always going to be some new company who's got that fusion better off and can challenge the existing status quo.
Good points. In 2006, Gregor, you oversaw the largest credit card systems conversion project in history while you were at Capital One. And I wonder, as you were contemplating an exercise, a project of that magnitude, what were the how did you think about chunking that? How did you think about planning it, the milestones, the project management type aspects, the way in which you staffed it? And then as it began to unfold, how did you continue to monitor it to ensure that it was set up for it and ultimately delivered successfully?
The first thing that's important about that effort is that it started a year or two before it started.
Okay.
And and the reason I say that is because the real work in a transformation of that type is the partnership with the business.
Yes.
And it sounds so trite, but we had worked for a year or two before actually launching the effort with the business around understanding where things were going in 2 to 5 years, and having workshops and just conversations pushing both technology and the business to frame up what are going to be some of the critical things we're going to have to be able to do.
Yes.
With both the systems, the processes, and the company, given your forecast as a business player, where the company's competitors are going and where the industry is going. Mm-hmm. And by pushing that, when we went to start this project, it was because the business was at a point where they said, we must do this.
Yes.
And so the very most important thing about this project was that I actually was a partner with a business leader who was taken out of the card business and placed on top of the project as the chief executive for the project.
I see.
And I can't underscore that enough. Mm-hmm. The person who did this, Rob Alexander, eventually became my successor at the company as the CIO. So, you know, he really took the risk as a business player to say, gosh, I'm going to change my career path a little bit here and work exclusively on the technology and not run the business, because I see the vision of what's coming and I know that we need to change.
Yes.
And so that was the most important thing, especially with something that large. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were literally changing the entire infrastructure for the card business, which was at the time the largest business for Capital One. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can't in any way say that this was one of those situations where technology did it and said, gosh, business, why don't you do this? This one was a real partnership, and by the time we got up to the board level, mm-hmm. for instance, to present, this is a big project, lots of money, it was myself and Rob Alexander, the head of the business at the time, who were saying, this is what we need to do. Clearly, then you step back and go, oh my gosh, you know, what have we done? We actually have to deliver on this thing. And it was a massive undertaking. And Capital One is a very analytical company. And so we did the process in three phases, a phase of analysis that said, what should we do? Mm-hmm. We went to vendors. We went to other companies that had done things like this. We traveled around to partners and looked at what they thought we should do. And so we analyzed and then tested through a couple of the possibilities. And in fact, I will say that we actually changed track 6 or 7 months into the project from one choice of a hypothesis of how we were going to go forward to the second hypothesis. Mm. And tribute to both the team and to Capital One for being able to say, gosh, this isn't working, or it doesn't look like it would work in the end, and let's change. And I think it was probably one of the most important things we did. And it was undertaken by the project executive, Rob Alexander, to say, we need to switch. Because as they looked at the tentacles coming out from the project team at the time that went into so many things underway, they felt that the complexity of that current direction wasn't going to work. And I agreed, obviously, with the team at the time.
I see.
But that change in path told vendors, you know, we're not beholden here. We're going to make sure we do the right thing for Capital One. It told the staff, we need to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. If it takes a little bit longer to do the right thing, we'll do that. But we really are committed to the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it told them, we care about quality. We really want to get this right. So in every area you're working on, let's make sure you do it at the highest quality. We dedicated a team of senior leaders. We had a combined group of technology folks, business folks, operations folks. We used very, I'll call them standard processes from a project management perspective, but rigorous ones. Mm-hmm. You know, every single week there was a review of all of the outstanding items. Anything past, literally a day past schedule, was reviewed. There were escalation procedures for getting quick answers. Mm-hmm. There was a board, in a sense, of business people put together that said, you know, these are requirement management processes and we need you to answer immediately. You know, get rid of this or do this, because if any one of these slows us down, it could have long-term trickle-down effects. But it really was one of the best-run projects that I've been involved with in the end. It worked fabulously well, even though it had hiccups, you know, and you expect hiccups, but that's a part of putting together a process like that, is that you put in the nets to manage issues that occur, and in the end, it worked very well for the company.
That's great. That's a very compelling story. I want to switch to a much less sexy topic, disaster recovery and business continuity. You are an executive who has been tested much and had your disaster recovery or business continuity plans tested to a much greater extent than most.
You were the CIO at NASDAQ on 9/11. You were the CIO at Capital One soon after, and in the process of acquiring a bank, Hibernia, in Louisiana when Katrina hit. Several disasters in the D.C. area, the D.C. sniper in October of 2002, and so forth. And I wonder, as you have contemplated business continuity and disaster recovery, a topic that is often overlooked. It's like business insurance in some ways, or life insurance, one of those things you hope you'll never have to use. How have you gone about that, and how have you compelled your business partners in the company and the board to put money and time against those plans to ensure that they're in fact tested and ready to use when called upon?
It's interesting because the you don't want to be an expert in disaster. Typically, it's not one of those things you kind of get out of college and go, gosh, I think I'm going to be an expert in disaster recovery. But I recently read a quote that some of the most interesting people you meet are the people with scars. And the comment rings true to me because you actually learn a lot through the actual execution of reaction to a disaster. And for the good or the bad, I've been through a number of disasters, starting with my home, my first home in California years ago in the 1989 quake. We were 4 miles from the epicenter.
Oh, my gosh.
Had that house. Not in a good state after that. So disasters bring out the best and the worst of people. And that's the first thing. And it is through disasters, again, that you will test your infrastructure and that you will see, you know, where things are good and where things are not good more than any other time. Mm-hmm. And you'll also see what's important and what's not important. So I have been through a number of them. And I think the first thing that you have to realize is that your obligation as the technology czar of a company is to ensure that you've planned for the worst and prepared for the most common. And I think that's an easy thing to say, but it's harder to see in practice. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean? You know, we, at NASDAQ, we plan for and we're ready for an all-out explosion in the data center. We executed plans on a regular basis for weather disasters, because those happened a lot. And so the first thing is to make sure your focus is on at the right level. You know, for the company you're in, what are the things that are going to happen the most often, and what are the things that are more likely than others? And make sure that you can run the business through those events, because those are the ones that you're going to be tested on the most often.
So contemplating scenarios and trying to determine what are we potentially exposed to?
Right. Okay. I mean, more often than not, if you have someone come in to evaluate your disaster plan, they'll look at the big scenarios, and they may not be relevant to you as much as the weather scenario that, you know, a hurricane may apply to, or an earthquake, for instance, out in California. But the conversation has to be a business one. And I hearken back to this notion of business alignment once more. The way at NASDAQ the conversation rolled out for disaster recovery was very, very simple. If the market goes down during the day, it's on the news. It's, you know, within seconds.
Yes.
And so the notion of disaster recovery at NASDAQ was a part of the fabric. It had to run, and it was a national concern if it wasn't running. And it meant that it had to run in seconds for a network that covered the entire United States with a 100 millisecond response time type situation. So it required different systems than, for instance, Capital One, where if you didn't get your bill from us, you weren't too crying about that. There are certain things, though, at a bank. If you went to get money in New Orleans, for instance, the day after, you wanted to get your cash. Mm-hmm. And you didn't want to worry about the fact that, oh, operations from the New Orleans Bank are on Tulane Street downtown and underwater. Mm-hmm. I'm off in some other part of Louisiana, and I want to get my cash.
Yes.
So the key thing is to really phrase the need in a business framework and let the business design with you the outcomes that would be acceptable given scenario 1, 2, 3, and 4.
I see.
And that's kind of how I've led it throughout. And unfortunately, there are lots of great examples that I can point to and say, well, in this situation, what would we have done?
Yes.
In this situation, what would we have done?
Exactly.
But, you know, it is also compelling that it's not always bulletproof. It doesn't always have to be entirely bulletproof. Mm-hmm. There's certain systems that are more important and certain things that are more important for business continuity.
That's a great point. That's a really good point. Gregor, I've been interested to learn that since you've left Capital One, rather than joining a new Fortune 500 company and attempting to do to embark on a new challenge that is somewhat akin to past challenges that you've taken on, you've gone in a different direction. Remain on the board of several companies and advise a good number of companies, but you've also been doing a lot of philanthropic work. And I know that your passion for philanthropy as well as your passion for technology is really coinciding and intersecting in a lot of the work that you're doing. And I wonder if you could take just a few minutes and talk about some of that.
Well, I appreciate it. I would love to. I will say first, I feel like I'm in fire hose mode at the moment. Because having spent, you know, some 20 years plus in the business world, in the corporate world, the first thing I really wanted to do on the philanthropy side was learn and get out and understand what are the needs and the struggles and the problems that are being faced, specifically in developing countries, but also in the United States, with regards to poverty, education, and environment.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, those all embrace human rights, mm-hmm. also. But I've been spending a lot of time in the field, going to sub-dollar-a-day countries, mm-hmm. And locations, villages, Nicaragua, India,
mm-hmm.
Guatemala, etc. Learning on the ground the plight and lives of what's going on in villages, to some degree. Doing that also through meeting with NGOs or non-governmental organizations, mm-hmm. Non-profit organizations, and really trying to get a sense for why doesn't it scale?
Mm-hmm.
We know the answers. If you go on the UN site, you can see the Millennium Development Goals, and you can see that in the 1980s, some even would say in the 1950s, we had a good idea of how we could end poverty and be better in developing countries with education and gender equality. Mm-hmm. And yet, many of those problems don't seem to be scaling to completion,
mm-hmm.
to being eradicated.
Yes.
And so a part of my struggle is to kind of look at that and understand what's possible there and how could a difference be made and where are some of the answers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's really... quite a profound way to use the talents that you have, and I imagine is the sort of work that is all the more enjoyable as a result.
It's exciting stuff. I mean, I was at a conference at New York University recently where they brought together a group of folks from all over the world looking at cost-effective technologies for developing countries.
Hmm.
It's called the CATER Initiative, and associate professor there has set up this foundation, this group, I should say, to study this. And the projects that people are working on are phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Remote monitoring of diabetes in sub-Saharan Africa, or something they call BusNet, to get network access to villages around Latin America using a bus that literally drives by your village with a Wi-Fi access point every day because it happens to be its transportation route. But when it drives by, it delivers whatever it was requested to deliver the next day, and it sucks up the requests for the next day. And you talk about low-speed broadband.
Yeah.
But it's phenomenal, the amazing technologies that are being put to use in countries, and really for the purpose of enabling either education, which is in great need of focus, or opportunity. You know, giving access to the ability to move your goods or find a buyer, et cetera. And much of this technology is technology leveraged in the United States that can be pushed out into these organizations. But also some of it's being invented there and coming back to the U.S.
Well, it's exciting.
You know, creating tolerance for networks here or other things. So it's very interesting stuff to be watching.
Sounds like it. Well, very good. I wonder if we can conclude on a more general question. As somebody who has worked in as the top IT executive for several companies and is a self-proclaimed geek, a lifelong geek, I wonder if you could pontificate a little bit about the future. What do you, as you think about trends in technology and how you see things developing, what excites you? What do you see coming down the pipe?
What excites me a lot right now in the business technology fusion is the empowerment of the individual through both social networking and collaboration tools, as well as what I'll call micro apps. And the kind of fusion of enablement that provides for an average user, whether it's the application to find the movie near them at that moment on their iPhone, mm-hmm. or whether it's the ability to find the order associated with this type of a product for a sales rep when they're working in the field. The notion that collaboration and tools are now prolific, ubiquitous, always on, and everywhere is real. And in some ways, it's actually coming at us in a very unique time from the consumer side into the corporate side. Mm-hmm. In the old days, the corporate technology was kind of where email came from and where cool stuff emerged, laptops, all of those things kind of came out of the corporate world and you were hoping to get them in the home. They were too expensive in the home. Now, technologies are emerging in the consumer world and you're wondering, when can I get it bulletproof enough to be inside the firewall?
That's a great point, yeah.
And the reality is that outside that firewall, there's a huge explosion of innovation going on that is related to this free-flowing collaboration capability. It's a fabric that just is weaving throughout things with open social and Facebook and all sorts of other tools. The notion that an application answers a single question now. You know, in the consumer world, you literally have thousands of applications now, whether it's on Facebook or an iPhone, that are targeted at answering one question. And they've got a group of folks that have thought about that, and they really have created a great interface to it. Mm-hmm. They've got good data behind it, and they're focused on that. And those coming into the corporate world, I think there's an explosion around how people will do work in yet another level. And it will put stress on networking technologies, data technologies, et cetera, that aren't, you know, at the level of what they need to be, mm-hmm. Both from a security and management perspective, as well as just a volume. I mean, the volume of data growth is outstanding in the world today. And we're racing towards a zettabyte of data on the planet. And most people didn't know what a zettabyte is. I certainly didn't until a few weeks ago as I prepared for a conversation with someone. But the notion that we're actually beyond petabytes and into zettabytes now, how will we manage that? Mm-hmm. And that would be the second aspect of this, which is data management has to have an entirely new level as well.
Great point.
And IT individuals are going to have to be battling with that, enabling that, you know, finding that needle in a haystack that now is bigger than the planet.
Mm-hmm. That's great. No, I think these are great perspectives. Well, Gregor Baylor, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Just listen to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. This forum has been created so that we might have a series of discussions with a variety of IT leaders to understand, evaluate, and define world-class performance as it relates to Meta Strategies' five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in a reactive mode, constantly fighting fires. If, however, systems and hardware work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It's important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business.
The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development to quality assurance through to support and all of the other aspects of the IT department, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important then that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming crucial to corporations, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our sound editor is Chris Davis, our web editor is Christian Dooley, and our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.